Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Sky Gilbert, University of Guelph drama prof, celebrated Canadian playwright, and vocal activist for our friends in the LGBT community. Just a few weeks ago, Professor Gilbert wrote about the assault on trans rights in the United States and the struggle for inclusion and acceptance. And then Tanya Granick-Allen happened last weekend at the PC convention and gave trans people here reasons to be worried closer to home. Considering the progress of queer rights in a busy news week is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. Policy Resolution R4 reads, "Be it resolved that an Ontario PC party recognizes gender identity theory, in quote marks, for what it is, namely a highly controversial, unscientific, quote, liberal ideology, unquote, and as such, that an Ontario PC government will remove the teaching and promotion of, quote, gender identity, unquote, from Ontario schools and its curriculum. Though it's non-binding and only meant to bring the resolution to the floor for the next party convention for a debate, the motion still passed overwhelmingly, and the mostly socially liberal citizens of Ontario were more than a little shocked. Doubly so when it was revealed that the person behind the motion was none other than former PC leadership candidate Tanya Granick-Allen, a woman so extreme, she was asked to remove herself as a Tory nominee in last spring's provincial election. The timing was also awkward, to say the least. AIDS Awareness Week starts this weekend, and Tuesday was Trans Day of Remembrance. Lisa McLeod, the Minister of Children, Community and Social Services, released a nice statement, again, no less than 4 days after her party agreed that gender identity was a, quote, highly controversial, unscientific, liberal ideology, unquote. Premier Doug Ford said Monday of Policy Resolution R4 that, quote, it came from the floor, I'm not moving forward with that, so it's done, unquote. But is it? What are trans people in this province and their allies meant to think of a governing party that wants to debate the end of gender identity education and pretend that the vote on it was inconsequential? Should trans people in this province be concerned? These are some of the questions I want to put to Sky Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert, who got his PhD from the University of Toronto in 2006, is an author and playwright with a collection of written work too numerous to list in its entirety here, and with numerous awards to his credit to boot. He's the co-founder and the initial artistic director of the Buddies in Bad Times Theater, North America's largest gay and lesbian theater, itself a source of recent controversy for Gilbert. So on this edition of the Guelph Politicast, we will hear from Dr. Gilbert on the current state of affairs on queer and trans rights, what the attacks from the Trump White House and the Ford PC party mean for those fighting for equal rights, and whether conservatives are serious about attacking trans rights and gender identity, or if it's just all about making a wedge issue. We also talk about stealth homophobia, what 2018 will represent in the history of queer rights, and maybe why Dr. Gilbert is afraid of woke people. That refers back to the controversy mentioned a minute ago. Anyway, I caught up with Sky Gilbert by phone earlier this week. So Sky Gilbert, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
I wanted to just start, because I can imagine your reaction to what happened with Resolution R4 when that news sort of broke, but I wanted to get your reaction to what's happened since, because you had Doug Ford coming out on Monday saying, it's over, it's done, we're not going to be debating it. And then, I don't know if you saw, but Lisa McLeod, one of the cabinet ministers, actually came out with a statement for Trans Day of Remembrance yesterday. And
so, no, I didn't. Go ahead.
Well, I'm curious then, because, you know, the messages are mixed here. That, you know, on the one hand, we have this floor vote, which supposedly represents the membership, but the leaders do not seem to be, I guess, equal to the desire to actually debate, you know, Tanya Granick-Allen's resolution.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I wish I knew more about the politics of my own province, and I'm quite ignorant. So I do know about Doug Ford, and I was paying attention to the election. I don't know. That is one of his ministers, is that who made the statement?
Yeah, Lisa McLeod is one of the Ontario's cabinet ministers. I think she's the minister of children and social services.
But is the statement coming from her, or is it's an official statement, right?
It's an official statement.
Yeah, well, it seems to be calculated, wouldn't it be? I mean, I would imagine that it would be that what's happening is that a mixed message, which is, of course, what Ford's idol, Donald Trump, does, is exactly what he's doing here. That's what you do. You send out mixed messages, and no one knows what your position is, and you change your position, and people are just befuddled and confused.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that's what's going on. Of course, the government doesn't want to appear anti-trans, so they're going to put out a trans-positive message, but then they're going to do things in actual fact that actually go against that. So, I will have to say that I do know about the election. I thought about the election. I thought about Tanya Granick Allen.
Mm.
And I think it's important to notice that she was on stage with Doug Ford. I keep wanting to say Rob Ford. She was on the stage with Doug Ford, right?
Right.
She was there, and he campaigned with her, right? And she is a really hateful person.
Mm.
And she is somebody who, I don't know, maybe she's nice to her kids, but she is hateful to people, queer people. And so it's and spreads a lot of hate around us. So and against women too, you know, and women's rights, let's say. So
yeah.
It's very, very, very problematic. And basically what happened, this is my take on it, is that I firmly believe, and a lot of everybody agrees with me, but that what happened with, I'm not saying that I was a fan of everything that our past premier did,
right?
But what happened was is exactly what happened with Obama. So in the sense that, why was there all of this negativity against her? Why was it so blanket? Why was there this deep hostility? Like, it's like Obama is the kind of person, for instance, just to compare him to our past premier, he is someone who I don't think he deserves hatred and anger, and
right.
Of course I'm on his side politically, but I don't understand this deep hate. I understand I disagree with Obama, or didn't like the way he did that, or he's incompetent, or anything you want to say about him.
Right.
Where does all this come from? And I think it clearly comes from, I think we kind of understand it. It comes from racism, so I think it kind of understands that it comes from homophobia. But Kathleen Wynne, I know it's a huge, people argue about this, but I was listening to a talk show the other day in which people were talking about a radio show in which people were talking mm-hmm. about overloaded rhetoric or stuff like that. And it became clear when someone was talking about Kathleen Wynne that he related the teaching in the schools to her agenda.
Right.
Right? And he was quite ignorant, if I may use that word, in the sense that he didn't seem to have any idea of what he was saying or what the implications of what he was saying was, but basically he started trashing her, and he started trashing it, and then it became clear the school, the education, and then he started to reveal that he was just saying, well, you know, she came in with a gay agenda,
right?
And the education thing. So that's what's out there. Maybe it's something people won't talk about, or they're not smart enough, frankly, to articulate. But that's what's going on. And you have to understand all this background stuff going on, that what's happening with Doug Ford is that he is playing to those people in the same way that Trump plays to dog whistles.
Right.
Like, he's playing to those people who go, oh, we don't want that homosexual agenda in our schools.
Right.
That Kathleen Wynne had. Yeah. So I that's what I think is, that's basically what I think is happening. Do you want to ask your questions? Because I could just yabber.
Well, I can interject with a question, because you hit on something. When we're talking about both Trump and Ford, there are people, you know, they both didn't run on the idea of you know, being a roadblock to furthering queer rights. And in fact, you know, when you think about Donald Trump, who spent almost the entirety of his life in New York City, undoubtedly surrounded by people who identify as queer, and indeed, you know, mm-hmm. when you're talking about his kids who grew up in, you know, private prep schools, yep. they were probably yep. surrounded by a lot of people who identified as queer. But then you have these kind of consigliere characters, and in Trump's case, you have Mike Pence, whose feelings about yeah, queer people sure. are well known, and in Ford's case, you have Tanya Granick Allen, and I think that it makes me wonder about, you know, they both Ford and Trump clearly are people who are not running on the idea of we are going to be stand in the way of trans rights or queer rights.
Well,
and then they
just didn't. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
I understand your question. I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, but I mean, what makes me very frustrated in all these discussions about Trump, and the same thing applies to Ford. These are not men of principle.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways they really get us caught up, and I can't believe that I've had to listen to CNN get caught up in it for like 2 years. Is, you know, why would he say that? And what is his position? He doesn't have a position.
Mm.
People are like, he does not have a moral position. He is amoral. I hesitate to call him immoral because I think it's actually accurate to say that Ford is amoral. So that means that he's a businessman. That means that they are prime. And I'm not saying that all businessmen are immoral.
Right.
But the principle of libertarian capitalism is amorality. So in other words, money, and you have to go back to Ayn Rand. And when I was a teenager, I used to be an Ayn Rand fanatic, so I know what this stuff is about. And you look at capitalism as beyond and above morality.
Right.
So it's a, you know, or let's put it this way, it's a good thing. Like, it's always a good thing to make money.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a good thing to, basically, that's it. It's always a good thing to make money. So,
greed is good.
So, yeah. So basically, that's what it's about. You're talking about businessmen whose main, and I'm not saying all businessmen are amoral and greedy, but the principle of capitalism is amoral and greedy. It's like when I talk about the patriarchy. Patriarchy is evil.
Mm-hmm.
Men are sometimes, not often, but sometimes individual men are very nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Patriarchy is awful. So similarly, capitalism is horrible, and these people are prime examples of capitalists and people whose lives, there's no need for morality. It's about how do I make money and how do we make more money for you people?
Mm-hmm.
And you people as capitalists, my constituents must understand that you want to have more money in your pocket, and that's what I'm here to do.
Right.
So, no, it doesn't, that I don't have find any contradiction in that, though yes, of course, it's a gigantic contradiction. What's going on is that they are amoral. So he didn't, Doug Ford doesn't have any principles. He doesn't have any beliefs. But why should he? You know,
mm-hmm.
apparently he started out as a drug dealer of some sort, and now he's our premier and has a shifty character with shifty business dealings, and now he's our premier. So that's what he's about. And yeah, that's all I have to say. So, I mean, I think it's
right.
not bogus, it's just kind of useless to try to figure out why he would be both sides fit. It's calculated, and it's amoral, and that's what he is, calculating and amoral.
And how do you appeal to that, though, or how do you, I guess, maybe campaign? Because I think we're seeing this in the United States, you know, when Donald Trump was elected, people thought that his amorality might have been an asset because he was going to, you know, blow wherever, which way the wind was blowing. But, you know, it seems like the opposite is true, that people who are amoral yeah. just sort of,
well, maybe it's a lesson people will learn.
Yeah,
that it that actually this whole idea of and as well, in many ways I am a libertarian, or I was,
mm-hmm.
but in many ways I do agree with like the idea of liberty and the idea of freedom and freedom of speech and everything. But this notion that morality doesn't matter, or that and that what all that matters is that capitalism function.
Mm.
There are two things that are going on in both of our countries. One is what we really have is a mixture of socialism and capitalism, just so that people don't think,
mm-hmm.
oh, you know, the socialists are coming. We're already, and the intelligent person knows that we're socialist capitalist countries, and we're democracies. So we're all of that. But democracy is very important, because democracy is the part that's about morality. I mean, yes, socialism, I guess some people could argue, tries to make a more kinder capitalism. But basically, it's democracy that's supposed to be about respect and humanity and giving people a voice and all this stuff. And I've lost your question, but I think that I don't know how we can I don't know what to, I don't. The huge question is how to deal with Trump. Everyone's dreaming about how to deal with this problem. How to basically deal with what are basic proto-fascist type, you know, type politics and that have no morals basically and are all about business and making money. I don't know how to deal with it. I think what you have to do is you have to. Well, first of all, you have to challenge it where I'm challenging it. You have to challenge it fundamentally.
Right.
That's always the difficulty, and that's always what I've tried to do in my thinking and writing. And it's like the problem is a lot of people are scared to do that. Like they're afraid to go right to the core and say, well, you know, we have to look at capitalism. Like we have to understand that we're a socialist capitalist country. We have to understand that we rejected pure capitalism in 1932 or whenever after the fall of the you know stock market. And we have to say we capitalism is amoral, and we need checks and balances, and we need to not be simply capitalist. We must be people who are democratic and people who are kind and people who take care of people. And you have to go back to that principle, and either you agree with that or you don't,
right,
as far as I'm concerned. And then you talk about that. And it's scary because there are some people who just don't.
Right.
We know that there's at least, 35, maybe close to 40 people in the United States of America who don't really care about any of that. That's important to know at the very least, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can deal with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are there too in their understanding of that, and perhaps we maybe lack leadership to articulate that. One of the things I was thinking about, and I was reading some of your pieces for the conversation, and you were talking in one about stealth homophobia, and that was in regards to the movie that came out earlier this year, Love, Simon, where the lead character, although gay and sort of queer positive, was still kind of the epitome of the squeaky clean teen, and that's sort of the only way you can positively present homosexuality. So it made me wonder, and this was kind of came out of your piece, is there real acceptance out there for the queer community, or is there an illusion of acceptance?
No, and that's the problem with political correctness, and that's the problem with policing of speech.
Right.
So when you police speech, you think you've solved the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody's allowed to say the B word about women, the N word about people of color, or the F word, I guess. So I call myself a faggot all the time. But I've gotten in trouble about it from my own gay people.
Right.
But it's like, but one reason I use that word is because I'm not for policing speech. And it isn't just because I think I should be able to say whatever I want to say.
Mm.
It's because I think that it leads to what you're talking about, which is that people think that it's okay because they're not using bad words.
Right.
And again, it's not about that. It's about fundamental ideas and notions. So basically, you're not going to deal with homophobia or transphobia, and I think they're extremely related. You're not going to deal with it in 10 years or 20 years or whatever. It's going to take a very long time if we're around, if climate change hasn't killed all of us. I think that's what I'm talking about in terms of, time. It's going to take a long time for us to actually begin to change the way humans. I mean, I would say essentially you have to, I deal a lot with issues of homophobia and where does it all start and stuff. You have to go back to the begats in the Bible. So you have a situation where we come from a culture that found it necessary to propagate. And the whole idea was you're going to be destroyed as a race if you don't propagate your kind, and you don't begat. So now we live in a world where if you propagate more than the minimal amount, you'll destroy yourself because there's too many people.
Mm.
So anyway, it's just that, so it's a fundamental thing. Heterosexuality becomes enforced because there was a practical reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other practical reasons, too, most of which I would challenge. But the people that are endemic, that are inside society in the back of everyone's minds for many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a definite strong fear of effeminacy in men, and I won't go into all the details.
Yeah.
But there's a long history of that. So it's What I'm saying is that it's really deep entrenched. So all you can do is begin to constantly constantly challenge it. And it takes a long time. So, no, you're absolutely right. Like, and so you have these cheery people who, and unfortunately, a lot of these cheery people are gay. So they're running around going, oh, everything's fine.
Right.
You know, I don't have a problem. And I speak to people, for instance, there's an organization that works with in businesses to make them less homophobic. And they tell me that it's a horrible problem in offices and things. Like mm-hmm. Gay men do not feel like everyone else in the office. And gay people don't want to talk about it because gay people are the cheery ones. They're trying to fit in.
Right.
And they're trying to be nice, which I think is actually quite a bad move and quite toxic for them and other people because it's called lying. So it's not like they have to be confronting people at every moment or have to be angry or have to be waving placards at work, but you can't pretend that everything's fine when in actual fact it isn't. So anyway, that's a short answer to a very long question.
Right, and in the anger, and this doesn't just go for queer people, but, you know, people of color too. If you're angry, you then become seen as the problem because you are angry about the social injustice.
But I would say assimilation on both sides
is right.
A lot to be desired. I mean,
right.
I really loved Obama, but I also probably like some people of color who are anti-racist. I felt like he was sometimes, well, people of color use the term Oreo cookie, like this stuff. There was the Oreo cookie stuff going on there, and he was, in fact, not completely black. And that's not a problem. I don't hold that against him. But it's like, you know, there were lots of ways in which I'm sure he had to censor himself.
Right.
In terms of, I'm sure he had to not be too black. I'm sure he had to. And that's, unfortunately, what happens when people from minorities get into power. It certainly happens with gay people when they get into power. They have to, you know, make sure that they are not too gay. But, yeah, that would make sure. Now, I'm hoping that we can talk a little bit about the whole thing of actually why students need this curriculum.
Yeah.
Can I just launch into that? Or maybe you're probably going to ask that, or do you want
You may launch as you see fit.
Because I'm just worried that I won't get that in. So, because I was thinking about it a little before the call, and I was really thinking about my position on this, which is really about, it's called You Live in a Digital Age.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, this is a major problem with this antiquated notion. There's so many problems with it. But it's like everything is available. All information that we now call data, whether it's true or factual or not, is now available online to everyone. And it doesn't matter if your parents take your phone away. Your friends have phones. So it's like it's everywhere. So, and porn is everywhere for anybody of any age. Hateful ideas are everywhere for anybody at any age. And they are, because the internet has become a very capitalist place, they're marketed now. So if that's what the Facebook problem is that hate is marketed. It's all marketed. Porn is marketed. And young people are defenseless against that.
Mm-hmm.
They have no critical faculty. And their parents are handing them cell phones.
Right.
Now, I'm not Luddite, I guess that's the word. I'm not someone who thinks that children
right.
or young people should not be allowed, I mean, to have access to phones or technology, and I think technology is great. But I think that what you do when you have technology, you have a critical, you need to have, offer young people the critical faculty and a critical framework in order to deal with it. And that's why you need an education in schools around sex education. I mean, you always needed it. But
right.
now you really need it, right? Because, and it's completely silly to think that if you don't teach students about masturbation, homosexuality, whatever, you're going to teach them about trans issues, then they're not going to know about it.
Because,
and also, it's a fallacy from my history of sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this is something that has been a fallacy going on for years. So it happens mainly around lesbianism historically. So because something about gay men, they always had to openly oppose it in terms of legislation. I'm talking about in the West and in
right.
Britain. You had to openly oppose it. But when it came to lesbians at the same time, basically what would happen is you'd have legislation about controlling prostitution and putting, you know, lesbians in jail or whatever. And then you'd have legislation about putting gay men in jail. But when it came to lesbians, no one talked about that, and there was no legislation. And there's a very, well, it's not famous, but for me, it's notable, quote by a judge who said, when he asked, when he was presented with something that he thought was a lesbian thing,
mm-hmm.
he said, like a play. It was actually a production of Salome in 1919 or something, Oscar Wilde's play. And he said, well, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something like, if we bring this to people's attention, if we bring this to women's attention, then they are liable to act upon it. But if we don't, then they won't.
So right.
This is a basic principle, and this is something so stupid and so silly, so high-bound, and yet people seem to think that somehow, you know, it's very much around women.
Right.
We don't tell women about lesbianism. I think it's because their genitals are somewhat more hidden, and ours are kind of out there for all to see.
Right.
But it's like basically they're like, well, they'll never find them. They'll never find their vaginas if we just don't tell them they're there. Like, it's so bizarre and so horrible, right?
But it's essentially the same argument against sex ed 20 years or 100 years later, that if you don't tell kids about trans people and gender identity, then they will just grow up to be regular old heterosexual people, even though some of them are probably likely living with, you know, maybe two moms, maybe two dads, maybe has a friend.
Oh, yeah, and never mind the fact that I would say that trans is a youth movement now.
Right.
And it's very much about kind of young people. That's the way young people are expressing themselves, and that's the way young people are expressing who they are. And so it's all over. You're going to have kids at school, and you're going to have many more kids coming out of trans.
Mm-hmm.
I think, frankly, because now I'm not trying to diminish the difficulty of being trans,
mm-hmm.
but I would say that what happens is that if you're comparing being trans and being gay, and there's some people, of course, will take issue with me, it's actually easier, not only in the sense to be trans in our culture. Oh, I can hear this here. But it actually is, because, and that's why it's so rampant,
mm-hmm.
is because it's easier. So a lot of students, like, in other words, people, parents don't like it, but they really don't like having gay kids. So what happens is that students can express themselves in that way, and I'm just trying to explain why I think it's so rampant. The way, I'm not saying that all trans kids are gay.
Right.
I'm saying that it's part of, if they're going to think they're different. I think what happens with queer kids is that they know they're different. I certainly did. And sometimes because they don't know about sex, or they don't have those feelings, or certainly the same feelings as an adult, they don't know what's going on. But they do know that they're not the same. And they do know that they have different feelings and different aspirations, and they're not going to fit in society the same way that heterosexuals do, and that, you know, cisgendered heterosexuals do. So they're everywhere, and a lot of kids are who feel different even are exploring trans. You know what I mean? And I think that's really important, and I think that so it's all around. good luck. Well, I think good luck.
What it sounds like.
From not knowing about it, since all their friends are into it.
Right. What it sounds like is it's a process now for a lot of kids, that there isn't just like the moment where you come out of the closet, that there are steps that as you're trying to discover your identity.
Yeah, but I don't want to make trans sound like a stepping stone to gay.
Right.
Not. I mean, it could be. It can be, but it isn't. It's all, there are so many different variations. I mean, it isn't universally. There are so many different variations, and yes, and that's one of the great things about the trans movement is it's all about kind of self-identification, and it's all about, and which is, I think, for me, the most major and wonderful contribution of trans is the idea that you must respect people's identities.
Right.
And anyway, so, yeah, I think it's all good, and I don't understand. It's just crazy. I'm trying to make a pragmatic argument with our capitalists, people who are now running our lives, and say, hey, good luck trying to not have kids know about this stuff. They know about it, and they will find out about it. So you need to give them a critical framework.
It's interesting you should use that word pragmatic, because it was a word I was thinking about in regards to your writing, is that and the most recent piece about, you know, fight for trans rights, but sort of get over the idea that there's going to be this sort of utopia where there are no gender definitions, and where, you know, we're going to be sort of free of that. And I also wanted to kind of touch on this, and I'm not sure how much you want to get into it, but, you know, you've been talking throughout this interview about how we can't be afraid to get into trouble if we're having these conversations, and you have gotten into trouble a bit recently with this poem you wrote, I'm Afraid of Woke People. But I don't want to talk about the contrary so much as what you were trying to get at, which is that the idea that we can't be afraid of having conversations and we can't be afraid of not talking about things the right way, sort of off the cuff. Because I feel, go ahead.
I have to agree with you. I just have to agree with you then. I mean, one of the things which the ways in which I'm probably more American than Canadian is that I was born in the States and I'm now a Canadian citizen. Thank God. It happened around Trump, but not because of Trump, that I rejected my American citizenship. I'm no longer an American citizen, but it's like what's very American to me is my attachment to free speech. So that's something that I was taught at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
And, I do have problems around, even hate speech. Like I don't like hate speech. That's a problem. That's my problem with it. But the other situation is that I don't like legislating any kind of ban on language, right?
Mm.
And I think it's just really, really important. I mean, I think children are under a certain age where they decide that is they're another kettle of fish. Yes, you have to have some sort of situation where they're protected from things. But in terms of adults, I will say it's difficult in a digital age, but still that's what you try to do. But in terms of adults, no speech should ever be banned or ever illegal, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you need to have an open marketplace of ideas, and you need to have the ability for everyone to argue about them. And if you don't have what hate speech does, it's like what I was talking about, political correctness, is what it does is it, in terms of language, policing language. Well, the same thing, basically. If you police ideas, which is what hate speech is about, then the ideas are still there. They bubble and they curdle underneath. And you've succeeded in making people say, well, I can't talk about it too openly because I'll get arrested.
Right.
But that just makes them hold their views more strongly. And, you know, and they bubble and curdle. So, yeah, I would say basically, and I've always considered that as an artist, that it's very important to be able to, that the artists need to speak freely. And that's mainly, I do write journalistic stuff, but sometimes my stuff sort of bounces into what else I do, which is being a novelist and a poet and a playwright.
Right.
That's what creative writing is all about these days. I mean, it's called mixing of genres. It's called fictional autobiography. It's called creative nonfiction. So what everybody's doing now is this mixing of genres. And so it's something which it's not, I don't think it's strange for me to be in that world. So that also means it's very important to have freedom of speech, because you can't go around now and say, well, that's a nonfiction piece, so that has to be taken as fact, and that's
right.
a fictional piece, and it must be taken as fantasy, because now we all know that they're all mixed up.
Right. Yeah. Maybe to wrap up, I want to get your feeling on sort of, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of the year, so we're in kind of a reflexive mood. I'm wondering where you think 2018 will sit sort of in the struggle for queer rights and queer equality, because this year we've had, you know, we've had a openly gay premier in Ontario sort of replaced by a government that seems to be interested in repealing some of the progress made. There's of course the Bruce MacArthur investigation.
But I'll tell you exactly how it'll be seen. It'll be seen as part of a pattern, and it's what happens at this moment in history when you have gay or black leaders in huge positions. You have a backlash. So, I mean, I think in the States, and I think that I would imagine, I know Canada's not the same as the States, but to some degree in Canada, you have a pretty big split on these major issues, or at least you have a sizable proportion of your population. I would probably think in Canada, certainly in Ontario, from what has happened, who really, really don't want a gay leader. So they are going to turn around the next election and go, let's get back to what we used to, a really old, fat, dumb, white businessman. We know what they're about. We feel really comfortable with them,
right?
So I think that's the history we'll look on it, and it'll be seen as a pattern. It'll be seen part. Hopefully, we'll get to a point then when there isn't so much negativity, and that's what the cheery people hope for about having a gay leader. But that's where we're at now, and that's the pattern.
Well, we know you're pragmatic, but do you still have hope?
It's hard to say. I do. I'm a very hopeful person. My hope comes from people's capacity for joy and pleasure. And that's how old-fashioned I am, in the sense that I'm a 60s person, even though I was a teenager then and I didn't really participate. Maybe that's why I'm romantic about the 60s, is because I was staying at home while everyone was having fun. I was a very good boy. But I think that the joy and of sex and love and free love and pleasure and everything, that was the 60s. We moved away from that. Mm. And that goes in cycles. Now, sometimes it lasts hundreds of years. But for instance, you had the 20s.
Mm.
And the way I look at it, you had the early modern period when people were, well, medieval period, basically, when it wasn't like it is now today. And then you had the period just before 1700, when there was a lot of, certainly in the arts, there was a lot of celebrations of sex and sexuality and stuff. And then suddenly in between 1700 and 1800, and lasted until about 1920, you had about 200 years of people deciding, oh, we have to be, you know, godly and religious, and art has to be circumspect. And then you had the 20s, and then you had the whole world of abstract art and Picasso and everything, and all this nutty explosion. And then you had the wars, the big war, and both wars. And then you had the 60s and this explosion, and now you have this incredible backlash, right?
Mm.
So I'm giving you an incredibly oversimplified historical view of the last, like, 400 years, but I think that I have hope because there are cycles, and that people love pleasure and beauty and inspiration, and they actually do like to get out of the house and hug each other and look at each other in the eye and talk.
Mm.
So I do believe that the digital age has limitations. It's incredibly seductive to not deal with the world and just dive into your technology. But I think there's a lot to be said for touching and loving and caressing and all that stuff. Like, there's something to be said for that, and talking and speaking and looking people in the eye and seeing their reaction, which is kind of what theater's all about, which is why I love the theater so much. And the theater will never go away. You couldn't possibly be a theater person and not be hopeful, because that's what theater's about, because it involves the idea that there will be interaction, because, you know, in a theater, the audience is interacting with the people on stage, with their responses, whether there's actual audience involvement or not, right? So.
Right. Well, Sky Gilbert, I thank you very much for interacting with me today and talking about these big issues. And hopefully we will get to, next time we chat, we'll be face-to-face and we can have those in-person interactions you're talking about.
Sounds good. Okay.
Thanks, Sky. And once again, that was Sky Gilbert. You can find his latest piece called Fight for Trans Rights But Let Go of the No Gender Utopia on theconversation.com. And you can find his blog, Another Blog That Nobody Reads, at skygilbert.blogspot.com. Before wrapping up, I thought I would also mention that ARCH, HIV/AIDS Resources and Community Health, have a couple of important events coming up for AIDS Awareness Week. The Night of Red, the Global Queer and New Perspectives on HIV and AIDS, will take place on the fourth floor at 10C this Saturday, November 24th at 7 p.m. And the local observance of World AIDS Day will take place at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church on Saturday, December 1st at 6:30 p.m. And for more information, you can visit ARCH at ArchGuelph, archguelph.ca. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. Check out the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you would like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.